This hour, an explosion and ensuing gunfire hit the Turkish capital Ankara, close to Parliament. Authorities say the incident was a terrorist attack. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi highlights the importance of Muslim unity as he addresses International Islamic Unity Conference in Tehran. And a pro-Russia party, which seeks to end military aid to Ukraine, wins general elections in NATO member state Slovakia. Thanks for joining us. An explosion has struck the Turkish capital Ankara, wounding two police officers. The Interior Ministry has called the incident a terrorist attack. It said the attack was conducted by two assailants riding in a vehicle close to the ministry. It said one of the attackers blew himself up and the other was, quote, neutralized. The targeted district is home to several other ministries and the Turkish parliament, which is due to reopen today with an address from President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Local media also reported gunfire in the cordoned-off district, where emergency services were in attendance. Our correspondent, Roshan Sakhalam, joins us from Istanbul to tell us more. Well, Roshan, I just read off what we had in terms of our information. Does it read correctly? What do you have for us?
Yes, Kaveh, as you mentioned, the General Directory of the Interior Ministry was attacked by two suicide bombers. As you mentioned, one blew himself up, and when the police tried to attack the other one, they were able to neutralize him, which means in Turkish terminology, eliminate the second terrorist. This happened at 9:30 in the Gizilay district, north of the Turkish parliament. The area is usually crowded, especially at this particular time of the day, because of the employees going to their jobs. And of course, the schools has started in Turkey. So this is a really critical timing. And also, as you mentioned, the Turkish parliament is due to reopen today after the summer vacation that took place a month ago. And President Erdogan was due to speak at the opening ceremony of the Turkish parliament. We all know that after the elections and the win of the majority of the parliament by the AK ruling party. Now, this is not the first incident that takes place, a terrorist incident in Ankara. We've been seeing a lot of terrorist incidents taking place in all over Turkey, near the Syrian borders, in Istanbul, and we've witnessed a recent one this year in Istanbul in the major Istiklal Street near the Taksim Square. So Turkish people have been slightly used to seeing such things. Of course, Interior Minister Ali Yerlikaya spoke about the incident as he said that we are not going to stop our fight against terrorism. He also mentioned that during the attack, when the police officers were trying to killed the second attacker, two police officers were injured, not major injuries, and they were hospitalized. He said that we are going to do some search and look for other suspect bombings. Also, in the area where the attack took place, special teams were taken to this area to look for other suspicious packages. And they said that news said that some of the cars were searched. One of them, which is the car of the attacker, of the attackers, had suspicious packages which they were working on. But we don't have any information whether they found a bomb or not. Also, let me mention that the car that they used was a stolen car. The plate of the car is from Kayseri, and the owner of the car was killed. His name is Mikhail Pozlogan. He was killed by two shots in the head by the attackers who left the Kayseri province and went towards the capital Ankara. As I mentioned, the area where the attack took place is very critical. It has the Turkish parliament, it has the Interior Ministry, and of course the area, the exact area where the attack took place is the General Directorate of Security related to the Interior Ministry at the street of Kızılay. Now, as I mentioned, President Erdogan was supposed to speak in the parliament. However, I think that the parliament will not convene today, as all the parliament and the parliament itself were Interior Ministry now is not closed, but the roads are closed, especially the boulevard, which is important in Ankara. It leads to half of Ankara, if you want to mention. And this, of course, created traffic in the capital, Ankara. And people are, of course, not feeling safe, and they're afraid of another attack, because usually when such attacks take place, they're twin bombings, especially in the capital, Ankara. We have been, we've seen in the past twin bombings taking place, so people are really afraid of another attack. However, the Ministry of Interior said that they are looking inside the parliament and in the area that surrounds it for any suspicious packages. We think that, and of course, every analyst in the country is speaking, that there are two possibilities for the attackers or who is behind this attack. It could be either Daesh or the PKK terrorist group, the Kurdish terrorist group that Turkey always fights and is now fighting actually in Syria and in Iraq. And we know that in the past few months, Turkey have excessively been attacking PKK in northern Iraq. And this has not been welcomed by neither PKK or mainly the Baghdad, the government in Baghdad, or anyone else, because they say that Turkey is actually attacking terrorist groups inside its territory, the territory of Iraq. And of course, the same thing is happening inside Syria. Turkey always say that our own goal from entering the Syrian border is to protect our own borders from the terrorist groups, PKK terrorist group, and of course other Kurdish militants from the PYD and YPG. So we still don't know who is behind this attack, but we are waiting for news from the Interior Ministry and the Minister Ali Yerlikaya.
All right, thank you very much for that. Roshan Saglam there from Istanbul, we appreciate it. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has called for unity among Muslims, slamming any divisive in the Muslim world as in line with enemies' objectives. Raisi told the 37th International Islamic Unity Conference in Tehran that Palestine remains the main issue of the Islamic world and a rallying point for Muslims. The president called for support for Palestinians' resistance and took a swipe at attempts to normalize relations with Israel. Raisi said those attempts are being pushed by enemies' puppets. The president noted that the U.S. and Israel are waging a hybrid war on Muslims, also by backing Takfiri's crimes and insulting moves against Muslim sanctities. However, he noted that Muslims must work together and use their major potential to secure their place in the emerging New World Order. Israeli warplanes have reportedly attacked targets in the Syrian capital, Damascus. Explosions were held in Damascus as media released images of Israeli warplanes flying overhead with Syrian air defense operating to counter the attacks. Details are sketchy at this point, as there have been no official comments yet from Syrian authorities. This comes as the Israeli regime has, on numerous occasions, struck targets in Syria as Tel Aviv pushes ahead with its acts of aggression. Palestinian resistance factions have organized a rally in the blockaded Gaza Strip, marking the 23rd anniversary of the Al-Aqsa Intifada, also known as the Second Intifada. It was sparked by the desecration of the Islamic holy shrine by then-Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. The Ashraf Shannon has more.
Palestinians in Gaza rallied on Saturday to mark the 23rd anniversary of the Second Palestinian Popular Uprising, which is also known as the Al-Aqsa Intifada. The Al-Aqsa Intifada was sparked by the desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Al-Quds in September 2000 by then-Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and his bodyguards. Palestinians have been holding protests in the eastern part of the Gaza Strip for the last 3 weeks, aiming to draw international attention to the continued Israeli human rights violations in Al-Quds. Hamas movement has warned the Israeli regime against violations at Al-Aqsa Mosque.
23 years have passed since the beginning of the Al-Aqsa Intifada, and we continue to fight for our holy places. The Israeli enemy must not provoke the Palestinian people. The equation has not changed, and Palestine remains an Islamic land. Today we assert that we will fight for our rights, and we will use all the forms of resistance, including armed resistance, to liberate Al-Quds and all of our land.
Protesters held placards denouncing the Israeli regime's desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. They also denounced the international and Arab silence on the unabated Israeli crimes in Al-Quds.
Intifada means that there is determination for Palestinians to face the Israeli aggression and colonialization and settlement and achieve Palestinian rights for self-determination and right of return.
In recent weeks, the Israeli forces have increased their presence near the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, taking advantage of Jewish holidays.
The Intifada continues because of the ongoing Israeli aggression against Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We call on the international community to exert real pressure on the occupying Israeli regime to stop its grave violations against the Palestinian people.
Observers say the Israeli regime and its regional and international backers are responsible for the escalation of violence in Al-Quds.
23 years on, Palestinians say they are determined to free Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, no matter what sacrifices are required. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Azerbaijan says a UN mission has arrived in Nagorno-Karabakh mainly to assess humanitarian needs. It is the first time in about three decades that the UN has managed to access the region. This comes as nearly all of the estimated 120,000 residents of Nagorno-Karabakh have left for Armenia following a recent brief military operation by Azerbaijan. Armenia has accused Azerbaijan of a campaign of ethnic cleansing, but Baku denies the claim and has publicly called on ethnic Armenians to stay. Authorities say 35,000 are now in temporary accommodation. A pro-Russia party wins general elections in NATO member state Slovakia. With almost all the votes counted, leftist Smer SD party, led by the former premier, Robert Fico, obtained over 23% of the votes. That left the party's main rival, the centrist Progressive Slovakia, in second place on 17% of the votes. Robert Fico's party now needs to enter a coalition to form a government. He seeks to end military aid to Ukraine, wants better relations with Russia, and is critical of the European Union and NATO. He has pledged not to send a single round of ammunition to Ukraine from Slovakia, which has been one of Europe's biggest donors to Kiev as a share of its GDP. Britain's government says it wants to deploy military instructors to Ukraine. The British Defense Minister, Grant Shapps, says the opportunity has arisen following a discussion with British military chiefs on Friday. He says the west of Ukraine has a better condition for such an opportunity in particular. This comes as the Ukrainian armed forces are receiving training in Britain and other Western countries. Britain has provided five-week military training courses to around 20,000 Ukrainians over the past year. London says the British defense companies have plans to set up arms factories in Ukraine as well. On to France, where the government there is continuing to enforce controversial budget cuts via executive decree, and even as the West's economic woes continue to rage. People took to the streets around the country demanding action on a long-running housing crisis, which has reached new proportions amid record inflation. Ramin Mazari has more from Paris.
In the past few presidential elections, the number one voter demand has been to address housing issues, which are suffered by one out of every four people in France. Many consider the European refugee crisis to be in its eighth year, adding to the national housing policy failure. The failure of Western sanctions on Russia has helped rent to explode over the last year by over 7%, or an entire monthly payment. Major demonstrations were held across the country to demand the government finally take action for adequate and stable shelter.
The government isn't proposing any solutions for these people with housing problems or who are completely homeless. These are people who work, who pay their taxes, and yet still find themselves on the streets. It's a big, big problem, but we don't expect anything from this government, given how they responded to the fair requests of the Yellow Vests.
Demonstrators demanded rent freezes and reductions, the taxing of real estate corporations and multiple homeowners, and the requisitioning of a record 3.2 million empty lodgings. However, historically, there have been few signs that the administration of Emmanuel Macron is interested in dialogue. The 2024 budget has just been released, but don't expect to see it debated in Parliament. President Macron has just used his usual executive decree to force through yet another austerity budget with billions in cuts to government services despite the record economic hardship.
Macron uses the 49.3 executive decree, so the people remain silent. People are scared, and that's now our biggest problem. This fear has led to inaction and political apathy, and that's even though I hear everyone around me relating how bad things are going for them and for society. I don't understand their inaction, but I do understand their fear of getting involved, given the massive repression and lack of democracy here.
Many say that housing is actually an issue which any committed government can fix in just a few years. By making laws which favor tenants and not rich landlords, by putting more taxes into building public housing, and by creating more shelters for those with emergency needs. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
China has slammed the U.S. as, quote, a true empire of lies, following a State Department report that accused Beijing of information manipulation. The Chinese Foreign Ministry said the report has disregarded facts. It added that the agencies of the U.S. State Department that produced the report were the source of false information and the command post of cognitive warfare. On Thursday, the State Department accused Beijing of manipulating global media through censorship, data harvesting, and covert purchases of foreign news outlets. Claimed that China has hit major setbacks when targeting democratic countries due to local media and civil society pushback. The report comes as Beijing accuses Western media of trying to portray a negative image of China. And that does it for World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this program, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a part of a speech delivered by Ayatollah Khamenei, leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the representatives of the people from the provinces of Sistan and Balochistan and Fars Khorasan. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on September 11, 2023. Today, despite the extraordinary development of information and security tools that US possesses more than anywhere else, Despite this, do you know of any country in the last 10 years whose government the US has been able to overthrow and replace using hybrid warfare? They conspired in Syria for 10 years, but they were unable to do anything. They stayed around in Afghanistan for 20 years. They brought all their military tools. Yet, you saw how they exited Afghanistan in disgrace. This is what we mean when we say that the US has become weak. That situation is not better when it comes to the decline that is taking place in Europe. Well, you must have heard about the situation in Africa these days. The countries that were under France's control are rising up one after another against France. The people are overthrowing the puppet governments imposed by France. Of course, their armies are busy, but the people support them. So the Western powers, which are headed by the US and followed by Europe, do not have the same power they once used to have. They are becoming weaker.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
This weakness is increasing every day. New powers are also emerging that I don't want to mention the names of these powers for now. I don't want to get into that now. This is a great global transformation. Now, this transformation is currently taking place. As I said, when major global changes occur, nations and countries' officials must be vigilant. This is the situation we are in now. We need to be vigilant. When we say that the enemy is becoming weaker, this does not mean that they are incapable of plotting, that they cannot show hostile behavior, or that they cannot inflict harm. They can. They are busy plotting. We must not fall asleep. We must not become neglectful. What do I mean when I say we? I'm talking about our officials and the general public.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A new study has shown that Britain's cost of living crisis that mainly results from the government's economic policy is set to cause premature deaths among thousands of people this year. The results of the research were published by the BMJ Public Health Journal. The study showed that the cost of living crisis and sustained period of high prices will reduce life expectancy among the people across the country by 6.5% this year. The predicted increase in premature deaths from a baseline of 463 per 100,000 people to 493 per 100,000 equates to thousands of extra deaths a year in the UK. The study says that the most deprived households will experience four times the number of extra deaths than the wealthiest households, with the poorest having to spend a large proportion of their income on energy, the cost of which has soared. Evidence shows low income is associated with poorer health, and that falls in income adversely affect health. According to last month's figures, the UK's inflation stood at 6.7%.
For me, this whole conversation is about whether I heat the house or whether I breathe, and it's so hard to describe what that feels like in real terms, because it's an immediate threat to your life.
Although it was down from a high of 11.1%, Britain's inflation still remains the highest among the member states of the Group of Seven. Meanwhile, there are gloomy predictions about UK's economic prospects. A report by the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics says that the UK economy will shrink this year and in 2024. It says a drop in GDP this year of 0.3% would be followed by a fall of 0.2% next year.
Now, if we look at the data that we've seen recently, obviously there can be some revisions in the GDP data. We saw quite a contraction in July. Now, we are expecting, perhaps there are some quirks in the data that we haven't seen as much industrial action recently, and there could be some technical issues and a rebound. But I think the outlook for the rest of this year is quite weak. And we see that, as you've mentioned, in the PMI surveys, both manufacturing and services moving into contraction.
There are fears that the UK is suffering from structural economic conditions. Factors related to the underlying weakness of the UK economy and the fallout from Brexit will leave the UK behind, while most other developed economies expand. The UK was also suffering from an unequal recovery that benefited better-off households, while the bottom half of the income scale continued to be affected by falling real incomes. Persistent inflation, falling real incomes of low-income households, and a shortage of workers will result in the drop in the country's gross domestic product. Cuts to government spending next year will also drag on economic growth. The central bank held rates at 5.25% at its meeting, and betting on financial markets showed investors expect there will be no change at the next meeting in November. The next move could be upwards should inflation prove to be more stubborn than the central bank's forecasts predict, despite a weakening of economic growth.
I think really what we're seeing is they are worried about the recession. They are worried about weaker growth, and they think that perhaps going into the rest of this year, inflation is likely to continue to decelerate. So what we're seeing is the lagged impact of fairly aggressive monetary tightening really starting to bite. And they're probably thinking, right, that here is a time to pause, but we don't want to get too complacent. There are still a lot of inflationary pressures ahead.
The economic crisis and persistent inflation has caused trouble for the ruling Tories in the UK. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's popularity has fallen to its lowest levels ever. Some 68% of Britons currently have an unfavorable view of the Prime Minister, the highest figure since becoming Prime Minister, while only 23% have a favorable view.
The truth is, the floor fell in for millions of families because of their economic mayhem. Yep. The classroom ceilings collapsed because he cut vital school budgets. Yeah. And now the walls of our national security have been breached because they've ignored repeated warnings. No one voted for these shambles. No one voted for him. So how much more damage do the British public have to put up with before he finally finds the stomach to give them a say?
Iran has vowed a resolute response to Israel after the regime's prime minister threatened to use nuclear weapons against the Islamic Republic. Amir Saeed Iravani said Israel's threat to use nuclear weapons is a serious threat to international peace and security, and the international community must not remain indifferent or silent. The Iranian envoy urged the United Nations Security Council to denounce Israel's reckless statement. Iran's deputy permanent representative to the United Nations has also denounced Israel's nuclear threat against the country. Zahra Ershadi has called on the international community to force the regime to abandon nuclear weapons, join the NPT, and accept the IAEA safeguard system.
The Israeli regime, with the support of the United States, has consistently opposed all initiatives aimed at establishing a nuclear weapon-free zone in the Middle East. The possession of hundreds of nuclear weapons by this regime poses a severe threat to the security of the Middle East and beyond. A vivid example of this regime's outlawed action is calling for a so-called, I quote, credible nuclear threat against Iran, end of quote, which was brazenly raised by the regime's prime minister on 22nd September 2023.
Ershadi slammed Tel Aviv's irresponsible threat, which he said was against international norms and rules. Days earlier, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had addressed the 78th session of the United Nations General Assembly, calling for a credible nuclear threat against Iran.
Sanctions must be snapped back. And above all, Iran must face a credible nuclear threat.
His office soon afterwards said that Netanyahu had misspoken and that his prepared text said credible military threat. Iran says the international community should reject and condemn any normalization of nuclear rhetoric and, in particular, the threat of use of nuclear weapons. Israel has a widely known but undeclared nuclear program. According to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, as of January, Israel was believed to possess a stockpile of around 90 nuclear warheads. But analysts believe the regime possesses 200 to 400 nuclear warheads in its arsenal, making it the Middle East's sole possessor of non-conventional arms. The Tel Aviv regime has, however, refused to either allow inspections of its military nuclear facilities or sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or the NPT. On the contrary, Iran has long been cooperating with the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, as a signatory to the NPT. Tehran has repeatedly declared that its nuclear program remains purely peaceful as always, and that the Islamic Republic had no intention of developing nuclear weapons as a matter of Islamic and state principles. Iran proved the peaceful nature of its nuclear program to the world by signing the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, officially called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, with six world powers, but the United States later quit it. Ever since the Islamic Republic of Iran decided to restart its nuclear activities after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, it has faced consistent threats from Western nations and their regional allies, especially Israel. The Tel Aviv regime has launched sabotage attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities and assassinated its nuclear scientists. Several Iranian nuclear scientists were assassinated between 2010 and 2020. Israel has pressed upon its allies that Iran's program is malicious, partly as a smokescreen for its own nuclear program and its scores of undeclared nuclear warheads.
What I call in English whistleblower, to inform the world about Israel's nuclear secret, because no one speak or no one report exactly what is going there.
In 1986, Vanunu duped Israel's vaunted security apparatus and smuggled a camera into the secret Dimona plant. His photographs exposed the world's greatest nuclear cover-up. What he showed was that Israel's nuclear arms program was far bigger and much more powerful than anyone had even dreamt possible.
Enough material every year for 10 bombs.
Netanyahu, Israel's longest-serving prime minister, has campaigned against Iran for almost 30 years. Israel has always turned a deaf ear to international calls on nuclear transparency, and it has never allowed any inspections of its nuclear facilities.
The U.S. President Joe Biden went on a three-day trip to Asia recently. His trip included stops in India for the G20 summit, then Vietnam, to upgrade their bilateral relationship. The purpose of his trip was to enhance U.S. relationship with regional countries, especially in a G20 format. But that is just a formal way of not saying what the true intentions of the U.S. president were. For starters, Joe Biden had said that his intentions to strengthen ties with China's neighbors weren't designed to contain Beijing, a phrase that he has repeated again and again. He has said things like, "I don't want to contain China. We're not trying to hurt China. America's goal is getting the relationship right."
I am sincere about getting the relationship right.
And one of the things that is going on now is China's beginning to change some of the rules of the game.
But his visit to Vietnam right after the G20 summit relayed a different message. The two countries signed a historic agreement to upgrade relations to the level of comprehensive strategic partnership. Joe Biden secured deals with Vietnam on semiconductors and minerals. So important is Vietnam for the U.S. that executives from Google, Intel, Amcor, Marvel, Global Foundries, and Boeing met with Vietnamese tech executives, along with the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, for more deals with semiconductors, the centerpiece of an action plan adopted during Biden's visit. So what gives? Why is Vietnam so important to the U.S.? It's pretty obvious. The U.S. wants to rival China and at the same time inflict economic damage. So much for Biden saying we're not trying to hurt China. But the U.S. has other plans for Vietnam, which was not announced yet. After the U.S. and Vietnam elevated their relationship to comprehensive strategic partnership, there were reports that the U.S. and Vietnam were negotiating a major arms deal, perhaps the biggest in their history, one that would involve F-16 fighter jets. Here are some interesting facts behind U.S.-Vietnam military relationship. Since an arms embargo was lifted in 2016, U.S. arms exports to Vietnam were limited to just Coast Guard ships and trainer aircraft. So, from Coast Guard ships and trainer aircraft to F-16 fighter jets? What gives? By the way, Russia has supplied about 80% of Vietnam's military arsenal. Yet Vietnam is just one of many countries that the U.S. has been selling military equipment to in the Asia-Pacific region. Here is one snapshot. Osprey aircraft to Indonesia for $2 billion. $2 billion in missiles and upgrades to Taiwan. $30 billion to South Korea. $2 billion in attack helicopters, as well as support boats to the Philippines. And $23.11 billion to Japan for 105 F-35 Joint Strike Fighter aircraft and related equipment. No wonder China is angered. The U.S. actions do not match its rhetoric when it comes to China. It is clear that it wants to militarize the region, very similar to how it did with NATO countries in Europe, the target there being Russia. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman urged Washington to abandon its Cold War mentality and to refrain from provoking an arms race in Asia.
China hopes that when developing bilateral relations and conducting military cooperation, relevant countries will effectively abide by the basic norms of international relations, abandon hegemony and Cold War thinking, stop provoking confrontation and stimulating arms races.
But that has fallen on U.S.'s deaf ears. The U.S. has gone all out to align regional countries with it. Hot button issues like Taiwan, North Korea, and the disputed islands are cards that the U.S. plays to its favor to do that. But the region will soon turn into a tinderbox if it hasn't already, and it would only take one spark, like the Taiwan issue or North Korea, for it to explode. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu on Israel-Saudi normalization. And here he is.
I think that under your leadership, Mr. President, we can forge a historic peace between Israel and Saudi Arabia.
The Saudi Crown Prince seems to echo the same sentiment.
Every day we get closer. It seems it's for the first time a real one, serious. We're going to see how it goes.
Two problems here. First, just days ago, it was said that Saudi Arabia had abandoned any normalization talks with Israel, which was reported widely. Yet when the Saudi Crown Prince was asked about it, he said,
"There were reports that you had suspended talks."
No, that's not true.
The Saudi Crown Prince, however, has said the issue of Palestine is of utmost importance.
For us, the Palestinian issue is very important. We need to solve that part.
Question is, How important? Is it a non-negotiable, or is it open for negotiations?
We have a good negotiation. Let's continue.
Now comes the Saudi foreign minister, who had this to say about it at the UNGA podium. To paraphrase his statement, peace that allows Palestinian people to have an independent state with Al-Quds as its capital. If that's the case, Israel-Saudi reconciliation is a non-starter. There's no way that neither the Israeli prime minister nor his far-right extreme fascist cabinet would agree to it. So what is the deal? Why is Saudi Arabia wasting time talking to Israel? How can Netanyahu say that he cares about the Palestinian cause, yet say this about their position?
But I also believe that we must not give the Palestinians a veto over new peace treaties with Arab states.
And while talking about the importance of Palestinians, his forces murdering Palestinians. Just today, two shot in the head, bulldozing their homes and detaining them. Is Saudi Arabia serious that it may reconcile with this apartheid regime?
Credible nuclear threat.
The Israeli Prime Minister was up to his old antics at the UNGA podium, using his props to make a point, a red marker and a piece of cardboard.
Today I bring this marker to show a great blessing, the blessing of a new Middle East.
This new Middle East that he talks about, referred to by Iran as West Asia, has already happened. It's called the Iran-Saudi reconciliation. Further proof of that, Iran's foreign minister hooking up with the Saudi FM in New York on the sidelines of the UNGA, where there was talk about a comprehensive cooperation agreement with Riyadh. But there's no denying there is a conflict of interest when it comes to Saudi-Iran reconciliation versus a possible Saudi detente with Israel in more ways than one. And what about the U.S. and the U.S. President Joe Biden, whose hand the Saudi crown prince has rejected on more than one occasion? The U.S. has been more cautious than the upbeat assessment of Israel, saying things like a breakthrough is far away and steep obstacles remain. But perhaps a point overlooked by the media may provide a window into what the real intentions of the U.S. is. One of the reasons behind the U.S. enthusiasm behind denormalization, countering China's inroads in the Persian Gulf. This was a clear reference to China's Belt and Road Initiative, a stance supported by the Israeli Prime Minister.
That great promise in the G20 meeting that you participated and led, you spoke about an economic corridor that would link Asia, the Middle East, and Europe together. And such a corridor will make Israel a very important hub on a highway of unprecedented prosperity.
The U.S. and Israel, through the trade route, as shown here, want to stand up to China's One Belt, One Road initiative, and as the saying goes, kill two birds with one stone through this strategy. But will it work? Consider this. China is Saudi Arabia's number one oil customer. Saudi Arabia has just become a new BRICS member. Saudi Arabia has reconciled with Iran, with many PGCC Persian Gulf countries to have done the same or are in the process of doing that with Iran. That's called the New World Order. It would be wiser for Netanyahu to reconcile with his own people, who have protested for over 38 weeks, before aspiring to reconcile with Saudi Arabia.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamidi.
Islamidi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, and welcome to the enlightening airwaves of IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Zainab, and you have tuned into the show that's all about vibrant world of today's youth. That's right, it's time for another captivating episode of your beloved station, Youth Station. Joining me in the studio today is my wonderful co-host,
Zahra. Nice to meet you.
Zahra, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
So, dear youth, we are delving into a topic that resonates deeply with our lives. We'll explore the concept of time and its division, as recommended in Islam through the 888 rule, 8 hours for work, 8 for worship, and 8 for the leisure time and rest. But before we dive into that, we will take a thought-provoking journey into the global spectrum. There are countries where the relentless pursuit of work leaves its mark, where individuals grapple with the pressures of productivity. And conversely, there are those places where life takes on a slower pace. What they have achieved and what they have lost in the process, we will explore this timeless wisdom today. So, fasten your seatbelts, dear listeners, and get ready for an engaging and eye-opening discussion right here on Youth Station. Stay with us. We have got an exciting show ahead. So, Sister Zahra, what are your immediate thoughts about the countries that work like hell?
I actually saw some documentaries recently about some Asian countries where working hours extend way beyond 10 and 12 hours. And there, in this documentary, it was discussing a mother and father who both had to work such high hours just so that they could, like, get by. And their biggest concern was their daughter, their small 4-year-old daughter, who they could just not spend enough time with because they were just so busy working. And obviously, 12 hours work has a lot more hours of exhaustion as well.
It does.
Yeah. So, like, before you could get by with like 6 hours of sleep, 7 hours, now you might need 10 hours.
Right.
And, you know, like 10, 12, 22, you get like 2 hours left with family. And
that's
how much of
disastrous.
That. Yeah. And how much of that really gets spent with family anyways? And like, you know, personal time, personal care, hygiene, stuff like that. On the other hand, there are places where work hours are very little or people are not given responsibilities. And so their rest and their leisure time is way out of balance.
It is. And talking about, again, the countries where the work hours are very high, I think what it has, what the result is, like, there could be productivity in the countries, but the individuals are suffering a lot. There are a lot of people, especially in China, whose tendency towards suicide has increased because of this work pressure. I remember the news when it was the COVID time and doctors were doing overtime in each and every country. But here in China, they were like working for not just 24 hours. They were working for days and nights together until the doctors themselves died. Many of them who could have saved lives, they lost their own lives.
Because
so that
being
was
overworked.
Really, yeah, that was really disastrous. So, you know, sometimes the overwork, sometimes the overload could give you productivity, but at the same time, you are losing the special forces in your country that could have been beneficial in different fields. Well, let's explore more on that topic. What about a short break?
The
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to your favorite station, Youth Station. I'm Zainab, and I have my co-host with me,
Zahra. We were talking about the importance of keeping balance in our lives and following the 888 rule. And we talked about countries that sometimes overwork their citizens and thus lose in the other two aspects of life and lose balance.
Right. They don't take care of their health and their well-being because that's something that gets affected with that overwork. And what we have lost in this pursuit, we're exploring on that. And now I think we should explore on the countries who have a lot of leisure time.
Yeah.
There are countries, you know, Sister Zahra.
Definitely have way too much time on their hands from the strange things that seem to appear from them every other day.
Like, let me give an example of, like, you know, Arab countries wherein the resources are very high. The, you know, there's a lot of money. But at the same time, the productivity on by their own individuals is very less because they don't have, they are not used to working or hard work or overworking and all. So even these people are not...
they're not living a good life either. They've ruined the balance of their life as
well. If overwork is not good, but at the same time, so much leisure is not good. Because they are, at the end of the day, they are independent on others. What's your take on that?
It's, I think, not working at all. Like, when we mean not working, we mean people who don't work at... They don't take care of their home. They don't take care of their family members. They don't go outside to make money. They don't do any kind of work. Like, not productive. Not lazy. Just in the sense of not making money. They will get nannies for their children and not deal with them. They will get maids for their house and not touch their house. They will pretty much do anything but do work.
Yes, because leisure is not about idleness.
Mm-hmm.
Leisure is not about staying idle. Leisure, Islam is not against your leisure time. Rather, we have been recommended to have a separate leisure time. But it's all about finding time for creativity,
mm-hmm.
relaxation, you know, and for your mental well-being, rather than staying idle and, like, you know, relaxing on whatever you have.
And so the result of such a thing is definitely people who end up feeling useless, people who don't have any self-confidence or have very bloated fake self-confidence, people who are just, like, there is no, like, result or any kind of outcome to their life beyond whatever they spend for their leisure.
Right. So we have concluded so far that overwork is also not good, and extreme leisure time just to stay idle is also not good. There should be a balance, and Islam has taught us that balance through a special rule, which is called
the 888 rule.
Yes, and me and Sister Zahra are going to explore that 888 rule after a short break, so stay tuned. Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We have explored overwork and leisure, and now it's time to delve into the wisdom of 888 rule in Islam. The 888 rule encourages a balanced approach to life. 8 hours for work, 8 hours for worship, and 8 hours for leisure and rest.
From what I've heard, this narration is from Imam Ali alayhi salam, where he recommends for people to split and plan for their days such that they have enough time for all of the things they need. And when you really think about it, you know, the average amount of time somebody needs for rest is probably between like 6 to 8 hours or more or less for kids, for elderly. And reasonable working hours, probably in most countries,
right.
It's accepted that 8 hours tends to be reasonable working hours. And, you know, family time, leisure time, self-growth, rest, those things also need to be paid attention to.
And so as you talked about self-growth, the time for worship is, when we say 8 hours for worship, it's not like for 8 hours you have to just keep praying, offering namaz and all. You could go for self-contemplation.
Self-contemplation, studying. Actually, we have narrations from the Prophet of Islam, salawatullah alayh, that the person who does not spend any time of their week in researching and in searching and learning about Islam and about what they is necessary for their continued growth in this life and in the next, whether that be, you know, their ahkam, maybe their belief questions, issues,
right?
All these kind of things that they need to get by in life, and religion and deen can offer answers to that. Somebody who doesn't go after any of these things is not a proper Muslim, because
indeed,
they are not paying attention to another aspect of themselves, their self-growth, their mental well-being, their health.
That's such a beautiful hadith. That's really a beautiful hadith. And thank you for sharing that. That's something really we need to ponder upon. And yeah, so leisure time or worship time could be a time that you could actually, you know, delve into something deeper and contemplate on things that are really necessary. So Sister Zahra, again, let me come to you. How do you divide your time, like your 24 hours?
I try to spend, I try to split my 24
hours. Which you're
not
regretful of. Like, you know, sometimes when I grow older, we are regretful of, I wish I spent last week this way, but all went in vain.
I wish I didn't spend that one night binge watching that show. I wish I didn't spend 8 hours playing a game
watching
for
that stupid serial.
Yeah.
So
I think one thing I haven't regretted is spending about between 6 to 8 hours for sleep or for rest, you know,
right,
like other than sleep, just, you know, laying down, chilling. Another thing I haven't regretted was as my duty right now as a student, or as in my duty as like a wife, in my duties as a daughter, in my duties as a active member of the society.
That balance is so difficult.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
balance is so difficult, but at the same time, it's not impossible.
Yeah, yeah. And all of these hours where work can be defined through my roles, like as a student, my work and my responsibility is studying. And I don't think I've ever regretted spending that many hours of a day studying what I was supposed to.
Right.
Or spending doing some kind of external work or some work in the house or things that are chores and stuff I had to do. Because it makes the leisure time that much better.
Right. But I'll talk about regrets here. I think one of the biggest regrets I have sometimes, although I have learned it now, when you pick up your phone without purpose.
Oh, definitely.
And the apps are designed in a way that you keep on trawling for hours and you end up nowhere. Like, it's without purpose. Sometimes I think it's very important to pick up your phone only with purpose.
Yeah,
before
definitely.
You pick it up. Know what is your purpose and, you know, fix your mind on that. Just focus on that particular thing and then go through it.
Identifying time killers is really important.
Yeah, if you don't have any purpose, I think you should not touch your phone at all.
Right, right. In general, in life, identifying the things that kill your time can best help you stick to your good schedule to live a good life.
Yes, dear listeners, because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, time is running fast and you are in a deep loss. Wal asr, inna al-insana lafi khusr. But do we have a way out? Yes, we do have. Illa allazina amanu, the people of iman. Is iman enough? No. Wa amilu salihat, you should be doing the good deeds at the same time. Is that enough again? No. Wa tawassaw bil haqqi wa tawassaw bis sabr, we have to come towards the haqq, towards the truth, towards the righteous path. We have to be patient, because just, you know, dividing this time, triple H rule, is not an easy job. It requires patience. Everything in life requires patience. So if we are patient, then only we can suggest others to
and,
be patient.
Yeah, and to both be patient and to find good friends that can help us in this and encourage others to follow this as well.
Right, dear listeners. So don't forget to share your thoughts with us, because your thoughts are going to make us more alive. Share your thoughts with us on English Radio at the rate of IRIB.IR. Thank you so much for listening. Also, I express my gratitude to Sister Zahra for being a wonderful